Hey, welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. Glad you could join me. Hope your season is going well, or if it hasn't started yet, I hope you're anticipating an epic hunting season. Freedom, chance to breathe without something covering our face, and watch our dogs. I mean, what else is there to life, right? Well, there's a lot more to it, actually, and some of it we're going to cover right here today. Pheasant season for most of us is just around the corner. I'll be talking to an expert in pheasant behavior, Scott Taylor with Pheasants Forever, about tips, suggestions, strategies, ideas that might help you become a better pheasant hunter. A little bit of biology in there as well, but don't worry, no pop quiz. We're outfitted by Cabela's, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. We'll also talk a little bit about finding some hunting grounds in the Southwest that are publicly accessible, and a few other things in that regard, plus a training tip for you and your dog that I, once again, learned the hard way. Don't know about you, but down to the wire on planning, at least for the first couple trips. Looking forward to being in Northern Nevada, an annual visit with my music school buddy. Yeah, we've been doing that for, well, we've been doing it on the fishing side for 30-some years, on the hunting side for probably 25, 26 years. You have any traditions like that? Doesn't need to be that long or with that kind of person. It could be just you and your dog revisiting some of the places where you, well, you have fond memories of one sort or another. I sure enjoy our little tradition, and I'm sure that you have one that you enjoy just as much. Okay, well, we have got a lot of good things happening out here, and maybe in your neck of the woods as well. Maybe the flooding has subsided. The hurricanes have gone away, at least for the most part. Here in fire country, the rain has helped slow down some of those fires. Not many of them are out yet. Not many of them are even 50% contained, but at least the smoke is laid down. Cooler weather has helped in any number of ways with that as well. If you are anywhere near any of those places, or you can reach out to them in one way or another, feel free to support not only the first responders, but the victims of these disasters all over the place. There's any number of ways to do that. The first easiest way might be talk to your local Red Cross. All right. Well, I'm going to get rolling here because I don't want to talk more about me. I want to talk more about you and what you're doing these days. And that is my subject. You know, every morning on the Wing Shooting USA Facebook page and the Upland Nation Facebook page, I ask you for a debrief on Monday mornings. How'd the weekend go for whatever reason, whether it was hunting or training or barbecue for that matter? And some great, great responses there. Melissa Otoya says she tried to keep her crazy short hair down, who's recovering from a nasty puncture wound. Wild squirrel chase ended up in stump collision. Man, if I had a nickel for every one of those kind of stories. And Flick is guilty of it as well. It's not squirrels with him. It's chipmunks. And I cringe every time he goes ass over tea kettles when he's chasing one. So, you know, that's one of those things we just learn to live with. There's one for everybody. Okay, let's see here. James Nielsen said he spent the whole weekend training tests. The season starts in a couple weeks. Richard Sweet, a beautiful picture of you and your dogs on the prairie for the first time. Way to go. It looks like you were successful as well. That looks like a sharp tail from my point of view. Good-looking dog in the foreground there. Fuzzy face of one sort or another. And then I love Celia Rausch. All she did was send me a picture. It's one of those, you know, the Garmin thing on your wrist that is kind of like a GPS. It has a big exclamation mark, and it says, Barrett is on point. Hey, really, what else is there? Well, there is one other thing. Lori Don Guile said she ran in a nice Cocker field trial. No ribbons, but lots of fun with our dogs. Yeah, you know, in a lot of ways, the reason we go to those is for what we learn and what we enjoy outside of taking home a trophy or a ribbon. So good attitude, and glad to hear it worked for you, Lori. Okay, so two quick messages, and then we'll jump right into our discussion topic of the week. First off, we're brought to you in part by Sage and Breaker Gun Care Products, crafted at the highest caliber. Yes, indeed. They sure are heirloom quality gear in heirloom quality gear carriers. My favorite is that one pole boar snake. Now, I remember when those first came out, and they were, kind of radical, you know, a new concept. You know, you throw the weight down, then you pull this long thing that looks like a fabric wad, but it's about 2 feet long. It works. Save you a lot of time, save you a lot of trouble, and boy, oh boy, do your barrel shine. Watch the videos. Remember, always free shipping at sageandbreaker.com. And also from Dogtra. Learn more about all of their products at dogtra.com, including the T&B Dual Collar System, which I still use every day on Flick. Talk a little bit more about that down the road in our Handle It segment. But in the meanwhile, take a look at all their bundles, all their discounts, all the new products, and the way they are offering free shipping on any purchase over $200, plus another discount I'll tell you about a little bit later in the podcast. Okay, so with the advent of pheasant season, I figured it was a good idea that we talk to somebody who knows a little bit about what we might be able to do to improve our pheasant seasons, whether it's biology and behavior, tips and tactics, strategies, and other hunting advice. Can't think of anybody better to do it than Dr. Scott Taylor. He's with Pheasants Forever. He's the National Wild Pheasant Conservation Plan Coordinator. Multiple degrees, a BS from Kansas State, an MS from Texas A&I, and then a PhD in wildlife ecology from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And then he went out and started working in that world for Nebraska, among other places. Now he's settled in as that National Wild Pheasant Conservation Plan Coordinator. Scott Taylor, welcome to the Upland Nation podcast.
Thanks for having me.
And, pretty simple question to begin with. That's a lot of words for a title. What do you actually do?
It is a lot of words. It would be my preference if it was a little briefer, but it is what it is. So my job was created in 2016, and the job kind of grew out of the National Wild Pheasant Conservation Plan, which was written by state pheasant biologists from agencies across the country, across the pheasant range. And one of the first things in the plan that they wanted to accomplish was to hire a coordinator to make sure that the other stuff in the plan got done, or at least got started. So they passed the hat around the agencies, raised the money for the position, and along with Pheasants Forever, who's holding the position, raised enough funds to hire somebody starting about 4.5 years ago. So I was with Nebraska Game and Parks up to that point in time. And basically what the plan sort of creates a forum for all those states to talk about what's important to them to accomplish, that is easier to accomplish as a group, as a partnership, than it is as an individual agency. And so that ranges from policy positions and communication with policymakers about what we think pheasants need, particularly at the national level, as well as research and management planning that, again, some of the states find hard to do individually, but some of the tools we need to do that properly are better developed by states cooperatively. So that's what I do. I try to keep the states working together on on those things.
And what are those things? I mean, give us some concrete examples of the actions that are taking place that are hopefully going to enhance pheasant populations and the places where they live.
So on the policy front, from a pheasant standpoint, certainly the Conservation Reserve Program is front and center. And that's part of the Farm Bill, and I'm sure you and your listeners are pretty well versed on the importance of the habitat that those programs create. And you know, Pheasants Forever has a great group of policy folks that are in contact with folks in Washington on those issues. What the states really bring to the table is the science behind the policy. So you know, questions like what sorts of habitat we want to see on CRP, how it's managed, how much we need, how it's distributed, those kinds of things. You know, what sort of plant mixes we'd like to see or prefer in those CRP plantings. All that science is accumulated over time, and much of it has come out of state wildlife agency funded projects. So we work with those folks that are talking to folks on Capitol Hill to figure out what information they need to make a more persuasive argument with those policymakers, and we try to provide the science to bolster their case. So that's one example.
How about on the what I'll call the more boots on the ground end of things? Are you involved in actual projects?
So the on the ground habitat delivery systems are generally state based rather than cooperative.
Yeah.
So most states have many states have cooperative positions with Pheasants Forever. They're called Farm Bill biologists mostly. And those biologists, more often than not, are housed within USDA field offices, county offices. And those positions are partnerships between Pheasants Forever, the State Wildlife Agency, and USDA, and sometimes other partners. So those are really the delivery. That's the delivery system. Then that's separate in part from our partnership. But we certainly... We work closely with all the, we are basically a different partnership than the delivery system, but we are in communication with, you know, their needs.
Sure.
And a lot of the questions that we're trying to develop answers to are so that those folks can better deliver those programs.
So we've got a plan. We've got people, actuating the plan. How do we measure our success?
Well, that's a good question. So in the original national plan that was written, it was finalized in 2013, so it's been a while since the ink was dry on that. But the states came up with their measuring stick was pheasant harvest. So they each state sort of chose a goal as a harvest level that they wanted to meet. And the trick was then to come up with a way to estimate the amount of habitat that would be required for the states to meet that harvest goal.
That's like reverse engineering almost.
A little bit, yeah. So, and it the goal wasn't based on, you know, numbers back in the 50s or whatever. It was basically in the early CRP era. The states were free to choose sort of a 10-year period that they referred to as their goal period. So so the trick was to develop that mathematical relationship between habitat acres, and specifically nesting habitat acres, of different types, CRP and small grains and the other types of habitats that pheasants used to nest, and what that meant for a pheasant harvest result. And so we had a first generation model in the first version of the plan, and we are now working on improving that model to make it a little more realistic. One drawback of using pheasant harvest is you need pheasant hunters in order to reach your pheasant harvest goal. And as you may know, we've been losing hunters for a variety of reasons. Some of it's related to lower bird numbers, but some of it isn't. We're actually losing hunters at a faster rate than we're losing pheasants. And so that sort of messes with your relationship between habitat and harvest if you're losing hunters.
Yeah.
It's a mediating factor there.
Sounds like maybe some states set the bar a little bit too high.
Well, maybe. But what it really says is maybe we need another measuring stick beyond harvest. And so the main reason that states used harvest was that was one thing that most states estimate on an annual basis. And that was one thing that we all had in common was these harvest estimates. But we're thinking about other measures of abundance that we can use instead of harvest.
What you got an example? I mean, I'm racking my brain for something right off.
Right. So different states measure pheasant abundance in different ways. Mm-hmm. A number of states do summer brood counts, and that's what their hunting forecasts are often based on. Some states do spring counts of crowing males. There is one survey that's not done by the state agencies, but it's done by volunteers, called the North American Breeding Bird Survey, which does count pheasants, but they count all bird species, so they're not pheasant specialists. But it does; those results do render an index, an abundance index, for the state. So that's one possibility to use, but we're trying to develop a method that can use whatever index that the states choose, whether it's their own survey or the breeding bird survey or some other survey to as their yardstick. So,
any talk of using multiple metrics? I mean, I'm thinking, all right, South Dakota quit counting their broods this year or something along those lines.
Right.
South Dakota also is spending over $500,000 marketing to hunters. So their harvest is probably going to go up. Maybe not because the population went up. So is there any talk of actually becoming a little bit more scientific about a broader suite of metrics?
We're certainly working on methods that can use one or more of these indices. So, and you know, whether a state weights one index more than the other in terms of what they think is most reliable, we can do that. But we think we have sort of a prototype that will allow us to do that, but we don't have that finished quite yet. We're in the midst of revising that first version of the plan, which includes updating that model. And so the pheasant biologists from across the country will be looking at that prototype and working on it and editing it and making sure that it spits out a realistic number in terms of the amount. Again, what we're trying to estimate is the amount of habitat we need to reach our goal. So
our, you know, to date, since 2016, do we have anything to hang our hat on in terms of metrics, measurable results?
Well, what we do know is that our habitat base continues to shrink.
Mm-hmm.
First and foremost is again, the Conservation Reserve Program. Acres enrolled in CRP has been declining in recent years, and that's for a variety of reasons. Some are market-based,
mm-hmm.
and you know, up till the 2018 Farm Bill, one of the constraints was the statutory acreage cap.
Yeah.
So, in this last Farm Bill, we did get the acreage cap increased, which was good, but they also chose to cut the rates that they were paying farmers to enroll in the program. So they kind of gave with one hand and took back with the other, and the result has been that our enrolled acreage continues to decline. So that's been a problem that we've not been able to overcome in the short term, but you know, there's always another Farm Bill coming up
mm-hmm.
that we can work on.
2023 is the next one, I think.
That's one. They're usually 4 or 5 years in between,
yeah.
And so hopefully we can remedy some of those problems in terms of barriers to landowner enrollment.
Are there any stars among the pheasant states that are actually seeing an uptick in whatever their metrics are? Number of hunters, number of acres, number of birds harvested, anything?
Well, I would say, you know, in the long term, you know, short term numbers go up and down. In the long term, one of the few states that has seen an increase in their pheasant numbers has been North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for whatever reason, speculate as to why that might be. Our northernmost state seeing an increase in pheasant abundance, but they are one of the few states that have seen a long-term increase. And you know, they are not the top pheasant state in terms
mm-hmm.
of abundance.
Right.
That's still South Dakota, but. And you know, historically, pheasant numbers in North Dakota have been sort of controlled by their winter severity.
Sure, yeah.
And so it appears that you know they haven't that they're severe winters. I mean, every winter, from my perspective, North Dakota is severe. But from a historical standpoint, pheasants are doing better, and those really decimating winters are getting fewer and further between in North Dakota, apparently.
Yeah, or just enough to matter to the pheasants, at least.
Right.
And I got it. So the opposite question is also good, and I don't want you to, you know, I don't want you to incur the wrath of any of these people, but I, you know, the one that I look at a lot is California, where the pheasant numbers in parts of the state used to be fairly healthy mm-hmm. for any number of reasons. The crops were right. The weather is perfect, and all sorts of other factors entered into that. But in the last decade or so, they've pretty much vanished. Mm-hmm. And you can, everybody has a theory about that, whether it's West Nile or it's something else, but I don't see the urgency in the state of California, which I visit frequently. I don't see any urgency there. And one of the reasons I speculate there's no urgency in a state like California is they really take this non-native species, invasive species thing more seriously. We all know that pheasants were introduced, well, right over that hill there that I'm looking at right now in 1881 to the United States from China, among other places over the years. But you know, if you ask anybody in South Dakota whether that bird was a native or not, we know what they'd say. Mm-hmm. But in California, whether it's brown trout or ringneck pheasants or chukar partridge, for that matter, they seem to be given short shrift to the so-called introduced species. Is that an attitude that we're seeing in other states as well?
Well, first of all, I'm not as well versed on, you know, California's policy as some of our other states that are sort of in the heart of the pheasant range.
Yeah, sure.
But I have had some interaction. I have traveled to California and talked to them about pheasants. And so I think their state agency folks still have an interest.
Oh, good.
And we spent a whole day, not just me, but representatives from, the local and regional Pheasants Forever folks, as well as their state agency folks, are concerned. And, you know, they've got a fairly robust research program.
Oh, good. Good.
Out there. So there is still interest there, I think, in California and you know, everywhere else. I think you're correct in that there are probably fewer partners now that are interested in pheasant conservation specifically, because of, for a variety of reasons, but, chief among them probably is there's probably a little bit of a growing stigma of working with non-native species, mm-hmm. more than there was, 20 or 30 years ago. But that said, I think most of our stakeholders, in terms of our partner agencies and Pheasants Forever, even, there's plenty of other benefits of developing pheasant habitat to society, from clean water, soil conservation, lots of other species benefit from these habitats. And so we can generally find a way to do projects for pheasants without necessarily having to use pheasants as a flagship species.
I remember sharing a taxi to the airport, one pheasant fest, with a gal who was there on behalf of butterflies. Mm-hmm. And it was right. The first time that talk got started. That was the very first year of that. And I see that, and there are all sorts of other, we talk about pollinators, we talk about clean right. water. What are some of the other, just in a nutshell, Scott Taylor, by the way, that's Scott Taylor with Pheasants Forever. He is the, hold on here because I got to read it. Yeah, National Wild Pheasant Conservation Plan Coordinator. And I'm very Scott good. Linden, and I coordinate what there is of this podcast, the Upland Nation podcast. That's what you're listening to, everybody. So, Scott, pollinators, clean water. When you go to California to talk about how we need to do stuff that will ultimately help pheasants, what else trips their trigger?
Well, if you look at what's important to the greatest number of people, surveys will tell you that clean water, mm-hmm. among all the resource benefits that habitat provides, clean water is probably number one on the list of general interest to the public. And so anytime we can make a connection between putting habitat, particularly grassland, on the landscape, and what that does to protect watersheds, we need to take advantage of that. Sort of an emerging issue in that same vein is carbon sequestration.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's, I would say, not a new idea, but in terms of the potential for maybe some bipartisan cooperation in the future on providing incentives to landowners to plant habitat cover on their land to, among other things, sequester carbon.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that appears to be emerging as a potential bipartisan. There's potentially some bipartisan interest in that. Those discussions sort of started in Congress this year, and they may, who knows? They may stall, they may accelerate. But it's an issue that isn't going away anytime soon. And so, you know, if we can use that to get more grassland on the landscape in pheasant range, that's only going to help pheasants. And, you know, if someone wants to do it because it sequesters carbon or provides habitat for pollinators or provides clean water, then great. Any of those things, any of those reasons are whatever's important to you, as long as it ends up benefiting grass and wildlife, then hey, we're good.
I vote for all of them. Good. Right. Great. Well, we're just getting warmed up here because we're going to talk about the nitty-gritty stuff in just a few minutes. But right now, Scott, if you want to take a quick break, I'm going to do some talking here and pay the bills, and we will be back to get more pragmatic about our pheasant hunting and pheasant behavior in just a moment. So stick with me, and we'll be back to you in just a moment, Dr. Scott Taylor. And we are brought to you in part by Dr. Tim's Performance Dog Food. DRTIMS.com is where you learn all about the variety of formulations they have, from grain-free to heirloom grain to all sorts of meats and other protein sources, which are the maximum. You'll never find anybody making a dog food with more protein in it than Dr. Tim's. Remember a couple other things. First off, you know those other folks who will deliver your dog food right to your door? Well, so will Dr. Tim's. And Dr. Tim supports the hunting movement, unlike some of those other organizations. If you need more incentive than that, you'll get 30% off your first order. So lay in a good supply for the season, get 30% off, use the code UPLANDNATION, and tell Dr. Tim I sent you. That's DRTIMS.com. We've got the Handle It segment coming up as well, right after this message from Electronic Shooters Protection. You can find more information at espamerica.com. I talk a lot about custom fitting, and I just want to walk you through this one more time. You can go to anybody on Jack Homa's espamerica.com website. Any dealer will custom fit you. Jack will make those. He'll send them back. Your audiologist, who you went to in your own hometown, will make sure everything's working, everything's fitting right. If they're custom fit, they stay in your ears, even in the field, and that's where I'm starting to use them now, because, you know, you do have to remember that hearing loss is cumulative. 30-day money-back trial, it's all at espamerica.com. Okay. You all know about the little parlor game, the wing on the string thing we all do with puppies and then maybe even with older dogs. And that's all it is. It doesn't train anything. It doesn't prove how birdy your dog is or how steady your dog is. Well, there are other things, and I'm guilty of them, and this is my confessional. I've been using a lot of great, well-made, and very useful bird launchers for training Flick. You know what I mean, the kind you put the birds in, you hit the button, remote control, and that sort of thing, and then the birds fly. They work great. Because I'm lazy, and those are heavy. Yeah, they're the big ones, the ones you can put a duck in, so they're heavy. I started using, again, those little net mesh Velcro harnesses. You can put a bird in it, and string on the end, you pull the string, bird falls out and ideally flies away. Yeah, much easier to carry. Unfortunately, Flick has clued himself into those and has figured out that when he sees one of those, he can crash in on that bird, and there's no chance the bird's going to get away. So we had a little setback yesterday, but I finally came to the conclusion, and this is the lesson in this for everybody. Be careful what you're training and what you're training for. That was simply a way for me to say, hey, you know, he can do this three ways, when none of them are really the ways that he's going to encounter wild birds in the field. So the harnesses go away, the launchers come back, Lick learns to stay steady, or the birds fly when he doesn't get to carry one around after the successful drill. If you're playing parlor games with your dog, why don't you consider why you're doing that and maybe abandon that approach for something that's a little bit more practical and a little bit more useful in the field for you and your dog. And back with us, Scott Taylor, the coordinator of the National Wild Pheasant Conservation Plan, and also with Pheasants Forever, who's the, I'll call them the lead agency, if you will. I know they're not an agency per se, but they're the ones, that's where, theoretically, who your work, where your paycheck comes from, right?
They sign my paycheck, that's
and,
right.
And so that's all that really matters. Okay, good. And I'm glad to hear that. I'm kind of surprised we haven't met before, but that's we'll work on that too. I promised everybody we would get down to brass tacks and talk about the stuff that's really important to us right now. So let's get down to it. First and most important stuff. Scott Taylor, flusher or pointer?
Well, at the moment, I am dogless. I can tell you that I grew up hunting over pointers, mainly quail hunting here in Kansas. But I'm also a waterfowl hunter, so I do see the utility, and I do enjoy hunting over flushing dogs as well. So I am fairly agnostic at this point.
How about your species loyalty? I mean, you just confessed to quail hunting. Can you pick one, pheasants or quail?
Boy, that's a tough one. If I owned a dog, I think I would have to be a little more partial to quail. But professionally speaking, I'm not going to turn my nose up at the species that
pays the bills.
Yeah, puts food on my table. So.
Yeah. Okay, here's an easy one. Over and under, side by side, pump or a semi-auto?
I shoot a Beretta 686 ultralight over and under, 12 gauge, and I bought it in 1991. So I've been hunting with the same gun for many, many years.
Well, you're the scientist, but I think that's 35 years or something. No, never mind. I'm not even going to do the math.
I was a grad student when I bought that gun. So.
Well, that in itself says a lot. But anyway, so if you were to go on an ideal hunt, would you walk out your front door and be chasing those birds, or would you drive somewhere, or maybe you'd fly to Argentina or something? Where would you go?
Well, I would say that I'm probably more into variety than volume. So Argentina is out. So it's hard to beat, say, Idaho for variety, anywhere in the Mountain West, where you can mix in mountain grouse, partridge, pheasants, you know, that kind of thing. I haven't spent as much time hunting in the West as I would like, but hopefully that's in my future at some point.
Well, you're welcome in Oregon anytime, so just give me a shout. Or Nevada, or Idaho, or Northeast California. That's my stomping ground, so come on down.
Great.
What is it about hunting that really trips your trigger?
Well, you know, it's been, it's, you know, with, as with most hunters, it's changed over time. You know, I used to hunt a lot, all the time. Sort of prided myself on that. But you know, as time goes on, I find that I don't have to hunt as often, but I like to make the most of the time out that I have. So right now, I think it's just a combination of well, the selling point to me is, particularly from an upland hunting standpoint, is it incorporates keeping you fit, and keeping you sane, and keeping you fed. And so You can multitask and bring all that together into one activity. It's hard to beat.
Well, there you have it. And with that in mind, let's talk hunting a little bit. Walk me, Dr. Taylor, through a typical pheasant's day. We want to get our heads around what they do. You know, they clock in and they clock out in between those two things. Is there a routine?
Well, you know, and we're talking during the fall. During
yeah,
season,
yeah, good point, though, because I was going to ask about seasonality, but who cares about the rest of the year?
Right, right. Well, you know, I don't think it will come as too much of a shock to anybody that, that hunts is, you know, the birds are typically roosting and spending most of their time in cover that they're obscured from predators. So, you know, structural cover that they can move around in just a little bit and not be seen. But they're feeding on more open ground. And so that's sort of the balance that those birds have to make is, you know, feeding as quickly as they can on that open ground and then getting back to where they feel safe in cover. So typically we're hunting in places where those two types of cover come together. And in most of pheasant country, that feeding ground is harvested crops.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, as most pheasant hunters know, you're looking for that combination. And so that's the routine. Now, that that anti-predator behavior, if the birds are getting bumped from places too often, then they're going to shift their range around. Again, not a big surprise. But there's some research out of Nebraska that suggests that actually it's the hens that move when they're disturbed, particularly by hunting. The hens will shift their home ranges actually more than roosters do. So that may be a function of, you know, the roosters wanting to, you know, maintain their social status, their territories.
Sure, yeah.
To the degree that they overlap between their fall and their spring territories. Mm-hmm. But so those are the factors that are most in play.
Can you put some times of day to this stuff? I mean, do they wake up at the crack of dawn and they start foraging, or do they wait until temperatures rise to a certain level, or how do we look at our schedule in relation to a pheasant schedule?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think they're generally, you know, on the roost until, you know, close to sunrise. And again, it sort of depends on what the schedule of, or their expected schedule of either hunters or other predators.
Sure.
If they feel that there are, their disturbance is coming, then they may leave early. And I think we've all seen the, or many of us have seen situations where the birds are flying off the roost, usually out of the places that we want to hunt, to someplace else. And by the same token, birds are often flying back to their roosting area just after sunset, just after shooting time. And typically those, in those situations, those birds have been pressured a little bit. And, you know, they're coming back to their preferred habitats, but not until they think that they're not going to be disturbed there. So
are they spending all day out feeding, or are they feeding a bit, going to hide in some, what I'll call temporary, roosting areas or loafing areas, and then going back out again? And, you know, is there, you know, a hierarchy of needs?
Yeah, I think typically your typical bird is going to forage a couple times a day, where it's concentrating on filling its crop once in the morning, coming off the roost, and then they're loafing during midday, and then going back out and trying to fill up again before sunset and going back to roost. So that's typical. You know, during the middle of the day, that doesn't mean that they can't be doing a little foraging. And, you know, a lot of times, even in situations where the birds have a lot of waste grain, they're also looking for natural food as well, whether that's greens or there's still a few insects around or weed seeds. From a nutritional standpoint, it makes sense for them to try to sample a variety of foods, even when there's a lot of waste grain. So they're doing some of that as well during those periods where they're mostly loafing. But in between those feeding bouts, you know, they're mainly trying to avoid being detected by predators because they don't want to burn up energy trying to avoid being
yeah.
eaten. So,
yeah. You're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. That's Scott Taylor. He is the coordinator of the National Wild Pheasant Conservation Plan. Spearheaded, I guess, would be a safe way to describe it by Pheasants Forever and coordinating all this. Are there any states, Scott, that are not participating in this plan that really ought to be?
I would say, you know, there's a few. And I would say almost all the states have participated at some level.
Okay.
Whether that's providing input on the plan or... our core group of coordinating states is also providing funds to support my position. So
sure.
There are a few states, you know, say California, for example, that, that I'm in contact with and that we communicate, but, they don't happen to provide monetary support for my
yeah.
position at this point. And, you know, some states drop in and out of funding status for you know,
yeah.
a variety of reasons because we all have budget issues.
Yeah.
But more or less, we have a pretty good core of about 20 states that are quote unquote full partners.
Wow. You know, I'd have never thought there were 20 pheasant states, let alone more than 20. But now I'm going to go look at the map. But first, you've got to settle a bet. So. My day job is making a TV show about bird hunting, and I was being guided by a pro in South Dakota a couple of years back who talked a good game about pheasants coming to water almost daily. Whether that's true or not, and whether it's almost daily or once a week or every 3 days or whatever, is there any truth to that theory?
Well, I would say, and you know, this comes up in quail management
yeah,
as
yeah.
well. The birds typically don't need water. That doesn't mean they don't want water.
Mm-hmm.
So you will find particularly, you know, when the weather has been dry or they're not, you know, there's not a lot of green material around. You know, I'm not surprised when people's local pheasants are seeking water, and
okay.
particularly in the drier climate. So, you know, and this is, like I said, this is true with quail as well. Typically, they don't need free water, but in certain situations, when it's there, they're going to take advantage of it.
Yeah, well, I know what you mean, and I hunt a lot in the desert, and all of those birds in the desert will do that more often than probably in a lusher, greener environment. So
right.
thank you. Good. So let's,
I don't know if that settled it.
Yeah, well, no,
I mean,
but at least I know my coat wasn't being pulled on.
Right.
So if we were to want to be better pheasant hunters, just off the top of your head, what are some of the things that you think we should do that maybe we're probably not doing or not doing enough of?
Well, I would say that, you know, thinking of things from a pheasant standpoint in terms of trying to avoid predators and being disturbed by predators, including humans, you know, you're going to try to not do the things that all the other hunters are doing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
And again, that's not news. We're always wanting to do what other hunters are not doing. So whether that means, everything from walking back into an out of the way corner on a property, or, leasing someplace where no one else has access, or hunting during a different time of day than we think other people are hunting. All those can work, but we can also sort of outsmart ourselves a little bit. In some cases, I mentioned, I think, some research in Nebraska that looked at both the behavior of hunters and the behavior of birds, and they were looking at hunter use of different public access areas, and they had one area that was near a town that didn't get hunted nearly as much as tracks that were farther, that were more remote, and they thought that was because people just assumed that that was getting pounded, and so they were, hunters were sort of outsmarting themselves in terms of, they thought it was being hunted hard, but in reality, everyone thought it was being hunted hard, and so as a result, it wasn't. So,
I love it, and I feel validated. I just sent that magazine story off to somebody, so it's been my experience. Absolutely. Not that it works every time, but it is, again, when you're looking to kind of zig when everyone zags, it's certainly worth a look. Along the same lines, yes, we all know that, cool season grasses adjacent to cut corn are probably, I'd spend some significant time there. But what about other habitat types that maybe we just don't think of as I'll call them almost as good pheasant habitats?
Well, that's a tough one. There's, as long as the cover will hide a pheasant, they will tend to use it if they're not being disturbed in it. So, that could be kind of small patches that sort of get overlooked. And it's obviously changed over time in terms of what we see as huntable habitat, particularly as sort of in the era of CRP. When I started hunting, there was no CRP. We hunted waterways and fence lines and crop stubble fields, milo or corn. And you don't see a lot of that habitat around anymore. And people tend to, number one. And number two, people, even when it's around, people sometimes overlook those smaller habitats, particularly if they've got a group of people they're hunting with. From a pheasant hunting perspective. So I would say that, there's no secret or unknown habitat. It's just a matter of finding those places of whatever size where the birds are not being disturbed.
Is speaking of disturbed birds, personally, I think they're all crazy, but so are we. But if we think we're on to birds, or we're in a very birdy location, we're just not finding anything. Would you suggest we do something differently? And if so, what should we do? Should we go deep into that, into that shelter belt, or should we look for wet ground, or what would your go-to plan B entail?
That's a tough one. Well, I would say, number one, if it's CRP type cover or cattail type cover, thicker cover, where I would expect birds to not only be spending time, but perhaps roosting. If I'm not finding any roosts, as well as not finding any birds, that might, tell me that I'm just in a place where either it's not as good as I think it is, or there might be some place that's actually better that if the bird that the birds are preferring to use. So I guess if I thought that there were birds in the area on the landscape, then I would try to figure out what the alternatives for the birds are.
And how far would they go? I mean, granted, you know, we've seen them fly half a mile, probably, maybe more. But, you know, in general, if birds are disturbed, how far are they going to have to go away? Or is it a matter of how far is the next suitable cover?
Right. It's a little of both. Mm-hmm. Typically, birds aren't going to move more than, you know, a mile or so mm-hmm. a day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're trying to move as little as possible.
Sure. Yeah.
To conserve energy and not be detected. So, but if they're pressured and their preferred feeding area and their preferred loafing and roosting areas are far apart, they're, you know, they're not above moving quite a bit. But beyond a mile would be probably stretching it within a day.
Okay. And just for giggles, because we have 1 million acres on fire right now here in Oregon, for example.
Mm-hmm.
What happens to, I'm not asking for the whole gamut of wildlife, but what would a game bird be doing if a giant wildfire was coming their way? Would they even know that it's coming their way? And then what would they do if they had the opportunity?
Well, I would say that your guess is as good as mine.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any science that would tell us that I'm aware of that, you know, that someone had radio transmitters on birds and actually observed their behavior in response mm-hmm. to fire. But certainly anything that can fly will use that to get away as much as they can. And whether they're going to fly in a good direction.
Yeah, exactly.
And with game birds, they're obviously there's a limit to their endurance. And so other than prairie grouse can deal with fire pretty easily. I would certainly hope that they're going to do what they can to get out of the way.
Let's go back to other predators. And I'm going to relate a short version of a long story. We were making a show in Kansas and we were all standing at the bottom of this draw, getting ready to hunt up that draw. And as the cameras were rolling and I was talking over my shoulder, I keep seeing something in the corner of my eye. And what I realize is there's pheasants flying out of that draw about every 50, 80 yards. A pheasant would get up and fly away. And I'm thinking, okay, well, that I guess that means two things. Number one, there are a lot of birds in there. But number two, and sure enough, about then, at the top of the draw, what comes out of the brush? One coyote boosted mm-hmm. everything out of that draw. Mm-hmm. So do we come back later that day? Do we come back next week? Are those birds ever going to arrive back in their roost in that draw? Or are they going to find a new home?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I think it's more of a frequency of disturbance mm-hmm, mm-hmm. type of thing. And typically, if birds are encountering something like a coyote, a mammalian predator that they can see coming, you know, they may fly, but they may not. They can usually deal with predators that they can see.
Sure. Yeah,
you worry more about mammalian predators, you know, either at night during the fall and winter, or mm-hmm. On nesting birds.
Yeah, yeah.
So it just depends on what the frequency of disturbance is there.
Sure.
And if it's just one coyote that's coming through, that's probably not going to be too successful during the day in open country. Then I don't think the birds are probably going to be too disturbed by that.
That's been my home covey experience here with Valley Quail. They keep coming back because we're no harm to them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
She won't let me shoot at them, but that's another story. Well, good to hear, and glad for that. Are there other threats that a bird will be aware of? And it's a loaded question, pardon the pun, but you mentioned mammalian predators. We're also talking about avian predators, aren't we?
Right.
And yes. They are they a bigger problem than coyotes, for example?
I would say that they are more, there's more variation in the degree to which they put pressure on birds. So we typically see increases in avian predation in the early spring and the fall. Mm-hmm. And that coincides with the raptor migration.
Oh,
so
yeah,
we've got, you know, everyone has sort of local raptors that are breeding in the area, but spring and fall we also get a movement of a variety of species in most of the habitats that
yeah.
that game birds occupy. So yeah, they are an issue all year, but particularly during those migration periods.
So let's go back to habitat. So if somebody said, Scott Taylor, PhD, you talk a good game, but I'm going to give you $100 if you can shoot a pheasant in the next 15 minutes. Probably more than Howard Vincent pays you, by the way, but that's between you and him. But and all the good ground has been covered, what are some of the less common but good habitat types that we should be exploring if we think everybody's already been tromping through all the cut corn and the sloughs and the waterways and that sort of thing? Where else can we go?
Well, you mentioned sloughs and waterways. You know, there's something about wetlands that are just sort of magic for a lot of wildlife, but pheasants in particular. And I can think of a lot of landscapes that, you know, otherwise don't look particularly attractive for pheasants.
Mm-hmm.
But if they still have some wetlands around, that can make up for a lot. So I'm thinking, for example, of south central Nebraska, where it's very intensively farmed. It's mm-hmm. as intensively farmed as anywhere, irrigated agriculture, but there are still some wetlands around of decent size. And, you know, in that intensively farmed landscape, if those wetlands were gone, I wouldn't think that the pheasants are going to hold on for very long. But because there are wetlands there, then you can have some decent hunting on those areas.
Yeah.
So I would be looking for places that still had some wetlands and concentrating on those.
Well, I advise a lot of folks if they're going back to places that have waterfowl management areas or waterfowl production areas.
Right.
I know it says waterfowl on the sign, but and I know you have to use non-toxic shot, but I have had pretty good luck finding ringnecks in those areas as well, and right. that makes a lot of sense.
Right.
All right, so now we got a bird in the air. We missed, because that's what I do, even on TV. And he flies as far as he flies, and we actually see him land. He's not going to be there when we get there, is he?
Not generally.
Yeah.
He's more than likely going to be keeping an eye on whatever threat he flushed from.
Mm-hmm.
And he may be where he lands for a while, but if he sees that threat approaching, then he's going to not be there for long.
So you're telling me that when he lands, he's going to turn around and look at us or look at where he thinks we are and see if we're coming after him, that sort of thing? I mean, it sounds logical, but we just never think about that.
I think first he's going to get in a place where he feels that he's not visible.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
When a bird flushes, they are vulnerable.
Yeah.
Particularly to raptors.
Mm-hmm.
So they're trying to get to a place where not only are they escaping the threat that they flush from, but also if they attracted the attention of any other predators in the process, they're trying to neutralize that threat as well. But certainly land-based predators, they're going to keep an eye on they're either going to fly far enough that they don't have to worry about it, or they're going to keep an eye on whatever threat they got.
My experience with quail and chukar in particular is you could mark that down with a laser pointer and GPS, and nobody will be there when you get to that particular spot.
Right.
It sounds like, to a degree, it's true for pheasants as well.
Well, and I would say that, as a scientist or someone that tries to adhere to that, there's a lot of these questions that we just don't have science on.
It's
basically speculation. So it's hard to observe some of these behaviors. And even when we observe those behaviors in a bird or two, it's hard to know if that applies to birds in general or
mm-hmm.
just that situation. So I would just add that grain of salt there, that those things that either happen infrequently or are hard to recreate in a research setting, we don't have a lot of good science on.
Yeah, but if there's any science, you probably have it. That is a scientist. He is the real deal. He's got a whole bunch of knowledge and experience, plus all of the credentials. Scott Taylor is with Pheasants Forever. He's the National Wild Pheasant Conservation Plan Coordinator. Leave us with one thing, Scott, and that is, here we are. We're just lowly pheasant hunters, and we want to help you do your job, and we want to help pheasants to flourish in the environment where they will flourish the best. What can we do as individuals right now?
Well, as always, the name of the game is habitat. And so whatever you can do to support efforts to put more grassland in particular on the ground, whether that's, becoming a member of Pheasants Forever or supporting some other conservation organization of your choice that does habitat work. And in a lot of cases, in most states, these are partnerships. And so a lot of organizations that are interested in grasslands are already working together. So anything you can do from a policy standpoint, talking to your elected representatives about the importance of things like CRP and Farm Bill conservation programs that you not only care, but you're watching
mm-hmm.
How things develop. That's ultimately that's the only thing that moves the needle is habitat. So that's what we need.
There you have it, Scott Taylor. Thanks for joining us here on the Upland Nation. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. I know I learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners did too. Thanks again. And what's left of your day, have a good one.
Great. Thanks, Scott. I appreciate it.
And a lot more to come. This Land Is Your Land is our public access feature. We're going to talk about some places you snowbirds might go. Maybe I'll see you there. I'll tell you about that in just a moment. First, go to Gunner.com. Gunner.com is the home of Gunner Kennels, the only double-wall roto-molded dog crate on the market. That's why it is so highly regarded by safety organizations and then customers as well. Lifetime warranty on all their G1 kennels. That's the one in the back of my truck. And yes, I can testify, 3 giant alder trees did not dent my Gunner kennel, but that's another story for another day. Been tested and proven to save actual dogs in real accidents. I'm a believer. Watch the videos, take the Fit Finder quiz. It's all at gunner.com. And if you're trying to keep your dog safe in the field, one way to do it is to ensure compliance with those life-saving commands. Dogtra's T&B dual collar is one way to do that. Before I forget, use the code SLUN10 and you'll get 10% off anything over $200. They'll also give you free shipping for the same amount. The things I like, man, I could be talking the rest of the day about them, but the first one is two sets of buttons. I use them every day, one on the collar around his neck and one on the collar around his flank. No toggling back and forth. You don't have to look at any touch screen or anything else. Two sets of buttons, infinite stimulation levels. Certain one on a certain level for those chipmunks and certain one on the flank for just a little bit of a reminder to whoa. Learn more at dogtra.com. Yeah, this is the year I might actually get to hunt in the middle of winter somewhere far away. And it reminded me that maybe you're thinking about the same thing. It's been a crazy year, but that might be just enough of an incentive there. And that's what our theme is for This Land Is Your Land, brought to you by the fine folks at Huron, South Dakota, where the pheasants outnumber the people. Learn more about my favorite South Dakota town at hunthuronsd.com. Start planning now for a visit to Arizona, the winter quail Valhalla. A variety of destinations, and some less common species and habitat. My friends in the Arizona Game and Fish Department have one hot spot that they would love to see you try first. The town of Kingman, you know, like in the Route 66 song, Kingman, near the border of California, Unit 16A, south of Kingman, toward Phoenix, on Highway 93 is a top Gambel's quail producer. If you'd like more information like that, it's all in my new website, findbirdhuntingspots.com. Also brought to you by happyjackinc.com, Happy Jack Inc., like incorporated, happyjackinc.com. Dog care remedies of all sorts for your dog's skin, coat, internal and external parasites, cuts and scratches, hot spots, and mange. It's all at happyjackinc.com. And one more shout out to espamerica.com, hearing protection in the field and on the range. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Jack. You can hear me, and luckily I can hear you as well. Happy Jack and espamerica.com. Well, I hope you learned as much as I did from Scott Taylor. Guy who walks his talk, knows his stuff, and is fighting the good fight for us when it comes to pheasant habitat and pheasant numbers. If you enjoyed the program, please do rate or review us, especially at Apple Podcasts. That is the red hot place to do it. Kind of the Nielsen ratings for podcasts. I want to thank those who have done that recently. Jay Hubis, 70. A Real Bird Hunter Who Cares. Jimmy CRF, 450. And Joel FP, thank you for your laudatory comments at Apple Podcasts. Appreciate that. All those are 5-star reviews. Hope I continue to live up to your expectations. Speaking of expectations, here's a quote from Agnes Sly Turnbull, who says, "Dogs' lives are too short. Their only fault, really." Amen to that. I'm sure you agree. It's almost pheasant season. Be safe out there. I'm Scott Linden. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you in the field.